What is a gray ghost?
I assume you're referring to the nickname of the bonefish, which is a sport fish that frequents the Caribbean flats and is known for its fickle nature and for its unsurpassed acceleration. When hooked, the bonefish can run up to 25 miles per hour. Anglers love the bonefish because it is incredibly cagey, since the waters that it traffics are not only very clear, but shallow. Any fly that lands on the water with too much of a thwack or any ripple that spreads out from the waiting angler's legs quickly spooks the fish. So it's, in essence, really the pinnacle of sport fishing in saltwater.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast all about the authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from members of Montana Public Radio and from Humanities Montana. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Chris Dombrowski about Body of Water, a sage, a seeker, and the world's most alluring fish, his nonfiction book that's part memoir and part reportage. So you've been a fishing guide in Montana for how long now?
Going on 20 years. I think this will be my 20th summer coming
20th
up.
20th summer. Mm-hmm. So around year 13, you were in what, maybe in Melvillian terms, the November in your soul, and you get this call out of the blue. What was this invitation?
Well, one of my oldest clients, a man named Jeff Miller, who I had met my first summer of guiding and who very quickly became a dear friend, invited me in the middle of that winter to accompany him to the Bahamas. He had planned a six-person vacation, and the sixth person had bowed out at the last minute but already paid their fare. So essentially, it was a free trip to the Bahamas for me, and I had hoped to catch some bonefish, something I'd wanted to do for a long time.
What were you seeking when you traveled to the Bahamas to fish? And was there a difference between what you expected and what you found?
You know, as I say in the book, I had spent years reading about the bonefish books and lore. It's kind of the pinnacle of sport fishing, if you will, because of its caginess and because of its speed. And so I was very excited to, you know, set foot on my first Bahamian flat and encounter this creature. What I found down there was an environment that was at once captivating and engrossing, and also a man, David Pinder, who essentially embodied that that landscape.
And I want to talk about David Pinder in a moment, but one of the phrases you refer to in the book is the tug is the drug. What can you say about that?
Well, that's a young, hip angler these days would laugh and find that kind of cliche. But the tug that one gets on the fishing line, on the fly line, when the bonefish is accelerating through the shallows is extremely invigorating and charges the angler with adrenaline. But I also refer to that phrase in my narrative in relation to the bonefish's importance to the Bahamian economy. The bonefish, when David Pinder, the man I referred to a moment ago, when Pinder first started guiding in 1958, he was the Bahamas' first bonefish guide. He made $5 a day. And at this point, the industry is worth over $150 million a year to the Bahamian economy. So that figure is astounding, but even more astounding to me is the fact that this fish that's largely inedible, any commercial fisherman who finds the bonefish in his net usually throws it back, or in the olden days, they turned it into dog food. This bonefish is the crux of an economy that once depended on the Colombian drug cartel for most of its money. In fact, Lyndon Pinling, who was the former prime minister, when he was finally ousted, he was found with, I think, $56 million in cash in his home, and most of it came to him from either Carlos Lader or some other cartel member.
Yeah.
there's this moment that you describe where David Pinder, your mentor in the bone fishing world, sort of narrowly escapes his own fate. And I'm curious about what you can say in terms of how he ended up as a bone fishing guide and not working on missiles.
Right. So Pinder was, quote unquote, discovered by a Floridian man named Gil Drake. Drake had in 1956 purchased an island then called Crow Carrion Key, later to be called Deepwater Key. He had purchased this island from the British Crown. And as you can imagine, it took quite intricate ties to the crown to be able to purchase an island in those days, not to mention deep pockets. And so Drake was looking for essentially some hired hands to help him clear the mangroves from the island and eventually build a fishing lodge. Pinder was about 19 and working on a U.S. missile tracking base near Freeport. I researched quite a bit, but could never really find exactly what that missile tracking base was all about. I'm sure it had something to do with Cuba at that point. But Pinder was working, lugging rock, essentially, on this tracking base when Drake found him and said, hey, would you like to come to work for me? And David said, of course I would. He went from making, I think he said, 50 cents a day to $5 a day, which even a poor mathematician like myself can appreciate that increase in salary. And so when Pinder went to work for Drake, he very quickly identified himself as a young man with great knowledge of the area. He had grown up foraging on this island and had encountered plenty of bonefish in his days, which secretly was Drake's true mission in erecting a lodge on this island. He wanted it to be one of the great bone fishing lodges in the world. And within several years, the lodge was operational, and Pinder went from being essentially a manual labor man to being the first Bahamian bonefish guide and quickly established himself as a star in that world.
Mm-hmm. Over the course of the book, you go back to the Bahamas several times, and you describe this beautiful handshake with Pinder at one point. And I'm curious, at what point in the process did you recognize the significance of your encounter with him?
I would answer that this way. I'm very slow on the important lessons in life. So it wasn't until meeting Pinder a few times that I began to understand that this man who had essentially built an industry and then after working in it for 30 some years was forced out because he had developed cataracts on his eyes and couldn't see the fish anymore and was let go with a severance of $18,000, which amounts to roughly $1.25 a day. When I first met Pinder, he was introduced to me by my friend Jeff Miller. And I expected to meet the equivalent of a football player who has been kind of thrown away by the industry that he loved or helped build, or maybe a boxer or some kind of punch drunk old timer. And instead, what I met was a man who had thoroughly absorbed the landscape in which he lived and lived this what appeared to me kind of enlightened elemental existence. So I would say it was a few times I met Pinder before I realized what an immense character he was. Mm-hmm. And it was about that time that he and I started having conversations about the guiding life, and we kind of made a connection there. So it took a while.
Prior to the Bahamas, you had another call to adventure, leaving Chicago to come to Montana. And I'm wondering if you can read the passage, which I think most of us who've moved to Montana can relate to as transplants, where you're looking at this map.
What does a map of Montana and its rivers look like to the young angler who, a day prior, was navigating Chicago's man-made canyons, but now stands sipping camp stove-made coffee at the tailgate of his used pickup truck near the mouth of the mighty Madison River? The brown swaths of wilderness land, the green swatches of public forest, the blue pupil-sized dots that stand for high mountain lakes, from which vein-like blue lines curl down and through drainages. Unfolded on the pickup's hood, the map looks like a wide doorway, each winding body of water a hallway leading to some room even more stunning than the last.
You also describe the horizon in the Bahamas in a number of ways, including a Mark Rothko painting. How was your psyche impacted by that landscape?
That's a great question. I remember thinking of it as the inverse to the contours of our country here in Montana. The poet Melissa Quasney, in a letter to me, described what I was describing to her in an early draft of this book as a soft place, very contrary to our, you know, horizon that is sharp with mountain peaks or our rivers that kind of charge down from elevation. So the immersion in that landscape was a great therapy to me. And it also was, you know, the yin to my yang, I guess you could say.
Can you tell us the joke that Merv tells you?
Sure. Mervyn Thomas is one of the great Bahamian fishing guides. And he says, you know the difference between a fishing guide and God? No, Merv. What's the difference? God doesn't think he's God.
So there's a reverence associated with fly fishing, which I think we have Norman McLean in part to thank. What are the ingredients then when an angler's reverence slides into arrogance?
Well, the guide has a tough task because he is, in a sense, a Sherpa, or he is incorporating some level of servitude into what he does. And yet he almost always knows more about what he's doing than the client or the customer. So it's a dicey proposition, and it certainly leads to some level of ego here and there. And, you know, this notion that we bestow some level of reverence on the fooling of a creature with some combination of steel and feathers can be a little bit amusing. And the best guides, I think, pick up on that.
You also write in detail about the impact your time on the Bahamas had on your work as a guide. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you can also read the passage about your post-guide exchanges.
Yeah, I remember reading in Peter Matheson's book, The Nine-Headed Dragon River, it's kind of the outtakes to his book, The Snow Leopard, about the Sherpas that he encounters there. And I read that book about the same time I was experiencing some discomfort with my relationship to guiding. I'd been doing it, as you say, about 13 years and couldn't make it work anymore, certainly existentially. And I read of Matheson's encounter with these Sherpas and his description of them and their complete embrace of their role as guide and servant. And suddenly this light clicked on in my head and I thought, wow, if you think of it as a vocation, it suddenly redeems, you know, the problems I had with it. So here's the passage. Always a bit therapeutic in nature, these post-guiding exchanges usually contained a bit of truth, a dose of braggadocio, a jab at a client's ineptitude or ambivalence, and maybe even an element of friendly trickery. Were the bonefish truly spooky in the Cross Keys, for instance, or was William simply reporting as much so he could have the flat to himself tomorrow? In Montana, anyway, I might buy a fellow guide a drink to grease the proverbial wheels, but the top shelf stuff was attainable solely through the barter system. Tell me something true, and I'll do the same for you. I reflected on how, to some extent, my own guiding had become, after over a decade of work, largely transactional. True, my days rowing the boat helped supplement the threadbare living I made as a poet and a teacher, but my passion for fishing, which I had loved to distraction since adolescence, even when pretty young women complicated the equation, had devolved into the occupational. My brief conversations with David had led me to believe that down here, anyway, the occupation of guiding was considered a vocation. Vocari, I remembered from an old poem, to be called.
You've been listening to Chris Dombrowski read from Body of Water, a sage, a seeker, and the world's most alluring fish. This is The Right Question. I'm Sarah Aronson. This conversation is available online at mtpr.org. While you're there, sign up for our podcast and visit our Facebook and Twitter pages. The book is really gratifying to an angler. What do you hope the access points will be for non-anglers?
That's a great question. I hope first and foremost that the entry point to this book would be the landscape itself. As a traveler to the Bahamian ecosystem, for me to put first eyes on something was a great thrill as a writer and as a person. So I hope that the landscape itself is kind of that initial entry point for a reader. I also think the book touches on issues of class and economics, the history and the potential for ecotourism, as well as maybe water's kind of unifying importance in our life.
Mm-hmm. I felt like there was an emphasis on relationships too. You to Pinder and the other guides, Pinder and the guides to Gildrake and the Deepwater Key, anglers to the fish to the shark, mm-hmm. the fly to the lizard, the mockingbird to the mangrove, and you even include dream states mm-hmm. and waking states. What do you know about the impulse in yourself to write in terms of associations and connections?
Mm-hmm. Well, by root and perhaps vocation, I'm a poet, so everything is associative to me, you know. I remember an early discussion with my editor on this book when he began talking at length about what the book was about. And the notion of the book being about something was completely stifling to me. I didn't realize a book of nonfiction had to be about something, but apparently it does, and this is probably a good thing. So as a poet, you know, I work associatively, and the challenge compositionally in this book became how do we give some order or some rationale to these associations, because there's a reason not everyone thinks like a poet.
One of the ordering elements also seems to be these epigraphs. You have Dogen and Basho and Patti Smith and mm-hmm. Melville and Shakespeare. Are these voices that are perpetually in your head, or did they reveal themselves primarily through the process of this book?
Some the former and some the latter. I have a very, for better or worse, fugal brain. And when I get thinking on something, what Patti Smith has to say about artists seems to apply directly to Mervyn Thomas, the fishing guide in McLeanstown at the east end of Grand Bahama. But other of these epigraphs came in a kind of shaping way, particularly the Dogen, whose Mountains and Waters Sutra applies, I think, quite poignantly to the life of David Pinder, in the sense that, you know, he says wise men and sages have always lived near water. And when we encounter one, as I think we do in this book, those epigraphs kind of come to light.
Going back to the classism, you also encounter racism, and I might even argue sexism in the trade of fly fishing. What was it like for you to encounter those elements?
In the Bahamas?
Yeah.
Well, you know, for me, encountering the subtle forms of racism and classism in the Bahamas was difficult to see, but maybe even more difficult to handle as a writer, because it's easy to lapse into cliche and sentiment in that sense. And also easy to just look like a post-colonial academic who knows a little too much for his own good. So dispiriting to begin with, and then challenging.
There are women in your book. They seem to occupy traditional or archetypal roles, childbearing, nurturing, cooking. But there are some outliers, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about Juliana Berners.
Sure. Dame Juliana, who really started the sport of fly fishing. She was a prioress and decided one day that her nunnery needed some more protein and went off to catch these fish in a brook. I presume they were brown trout. And she fashioned probably the first fly rod, no reel at that time, but the first fly rod and fly out of some feathers and a hook, and began catching fish out of the small stream that ran through their property, and essentially became the first fly angler that we know. Of course, Isaac Walton is given most of the credit, but I believe she predated him by a couple of centuries anyway.
That's amazing. And then one of David's daughters, Linda, mm-hmm. tries to break in. Mm-hmm. How did that go?
A couple of generations of David's progeny have become guides. And Linda, who says, I see the bonefish better than my brothers do, goes to the lodge and says, you should make me your first female guide. Like most great artists, she's probably ahead of her time, because now I can actually envision something that like that happening. But when she made this approach to the lodge, they said, no, you're needed in the kitchen.
When was that?
I don't think it's dated in the book, but it would have been roughly 96, 97.
Wow, that's recent. One of the arguments you circle in this book is the fly rod being a tool for democracy mm-hmm. in the Bahamas. What can you speak to about that?
Sure. Well, it's definitely an idea that came to me via Prescott Smith, who is a conservationist and a fishing guide in the Bahamas. He lives on Andros Island and is outspoken against development, particularly for the way development on limestone islands destroys the freshwater lens, which is created when rain falls on limestone, percolates through the rock and spreads out to kind of cleanse the water near the mangrove shelves. So Prescott gave me that idea that the fly rod is essentially a tool for democracy. And his notion is that true conservation only happens when initiated and sustained by locals, people who are in need of a sustainable economy and who are invested in a place over a long period of time, not just to see their investment turn money.
One of the maybe most special things about this book, on the front, you have a blurb by Jim Harrison. And 10 days before he died, the New York Times ran an interview with him in which he mentioned your book being on his nightstand. What's that like for you to know?
Well, I mean, it's humbling for sure. It's a bit melancholy to consider at this point, but also it's an honor and a thrill that to think of Jim reading this book before he passed.
What was your relationship with him?
Jim was a dear friend who very early on championed my poetic efforts, in particular my first two books. And he tolerated the notion that I would attempt to write prose as well, because he said, you know, you have to feed your family. But one of his favorite sayings was, and I won't do this in my patented nasalette Harrison accent, but he would say, the only way they're ever going to respect you is if you demand more money from them. So for Jim, everything fed his poetry. His novels were an excuse to buy himself time to write more poetry, because he decided against the academic world and he didn't want to become a teacher, per se, and earn his living that way. So we spent a lot of time talking poetry, and we spent a lot of time on the water together.
And you interviewed him And you wrote a piece about him as well. And there was one sentence in your book which reminded me of that interview where you wrote, "Here, the fully extended back cast, waiting for the forward cast to propel it to its destination, breathes a pause, an emptiness at the root of which all good lies." Mm-hmm. Do you remember the secret Jim told you in the interview that you did with him?
Sure, yeah. I think we were talking about that nada, right?
Exactly.
Sure, yeah. He had connected it somehow to the notion of cleavage, if I remember right. And he said basically, this male obsession exists because of nothingness.
Exactly.
Am I right? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Sort of the emptiness,
right.
Which all good lies.
Right.
I like that.
Yeah, I believe he began that that soliloquy, you know, or monologue with Jim. It was always a soliloquy or a monologue. I mean, he was the perpetual narrator. He could tell a story. We would walk, you know, walk past two people on the street, or float past two people, or drive past a young man who was milking a cow out in a field, and he would begin to tell the story of a fictionalized story of that young man's life and why he was out in the field, because he had cussed at his mother earlier in the morning, and he would go on and on and on and on and on. So I believe that story to which you were referring begins with Jim asking, "Do you want to know how you can believe in God?"
Yeah. One of the more interesting things about this book, which listeners can't see, is there's aqua text studded throughout. Mm-hmm. And I'm really curious about the design decision and the content of those particular passages.
Well, the design work was all done by an amazing book designer named Mary Austin Speaker, who you mentioned Patti Smith earlier. She has designed both of Patti Smith's last two books. And we dealt with a few passages that delved the kind of historical nature of David Pinder's life. Many of the interviews and sessions that he and I had led to my kind of exploring his life in narrative. He would tell me a story about, say, an encounter with a famous golfer whose wife was very disrespectful and racist to him as a guide. And I would, instead of, you know, using that quote somewhere, try to describe it in narrative. Many of those passages were edited out of the book, but some of them stuck and became these kind of past tense flashbacks, if you will. And Mary Speaker decided the best way to set those in the book would be in a different color font. So I think it worked.
Chris Dombrowski lives in Missoula, Montana. Look for more information about him and his book and subscribe to our podcast at mtpr.org. Also there, you'll find children's book reviews, poetry, and links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridas. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.